So I'm going to continue these from yesterday when I was talking about parton construction. So let's see. So I don't know if I should review where I was, but essentially, just a quick reminder, I told you about a general way. I talked about slave fermion construction in particular, and I told you how it takes as input a non-interacting fermion Hamiltonian and produces as output a spin state, which can be highly entangled and perhaps belonging to an interesting phase. And it also produces a low energy theory, which is some kind of gauge theory. And the claim is that the spin state is a physical state and that the gauge theory is describing the excitations of that physical state. So it's producing a state and an associated low energy theory. And so far, I just told you how the prescription works. I didn't try to justify it, really. What I want to do next is, it's not exactly a justification, but I just want to give you a little bit of a physical picture for why it isn't crazy that there's this gauge theory description. It seems on its surface just like I pulled that gauge theory out of thin air. Like, why in the world should this spin state be described by a gauge theory? So I just want to give you a little bit of sense of why there is some gauge structure in this, hidden in that wave function. The wave function has a kind of gauge structure to it. And so that's what I want to talk about next. And that's this, I'll say the physical picture, a physical picture for the gauge field. Okay, so let's just for concreteness, let's focus on this one example that we talked about last time, which was this pi state. If you may remember that, although we didn't write down the actual wave function, to construct the spin wave function, the way you do it is you project the free fermion ground state psi naught into the spin Hilbert space. That's what this P operator does. So psi naught here was the ground state of some fermion Hamiltonian, which in this case only had hopping terms. So it was of this form Tij Fi alpha dagger Fj alpha. Okay. So what I kind of want to let's say just focusing on this example, how can we see that there's something like a gauge field excitation or something resembling a gauge field fluctuation about this spin state? So to see that, one way to see that is let's try to construct some kind of wave function which is close to psi spin. It's, but not, so we want to perturb this wave function. We want to construct new wave functions, which presumably would have low energy under any reasonable Hamiltonian. So one way to perturb psi spin is the following. Basically, what we can do is perturb our ansatz, perturb our H naught. So let's define a new wave function. I'll call it psi spin theta ij. And this is going to be obtained by basically projecting some other fermion state. I'll call psi naught theta ij. And what is psi naught theta ij? Psi naught theta ij is the ground state of some modified ansatz. It's the ground state of, call it H naught theta ij. And H naught theta ij is just my original ansatz, but I'm gonna put instead of having a hopping amplitude Tij, I'll have a hopping amplitude Tij e to the I theta ij. I'm out of room here, but I want Hermitian conjugate there. Okay, so all we've done here is just modified the phase of our hopping. If theta ij is small, then at least we can view this wave function will be close to our original wave function. It'll have a similar expectation values for local operators and so on. So now, and here's an interesting, so we can think of this, by the way, as a little bit like a generalization of like creating a spin wave or something. Like in typical mean field theory, you have some state and you can perturb it by, you know, moving, twisting your mean field, maybe spatially, different points in space. And here we're doing something like that, except instead of a twisting some external field or the direction of some external field, we're changing these hopping amplitudes in space. So it's some kind of generalized spin wave. But what's interesting about it is that unlike a regular spin wave, it has a gauge redundancy. So key point is that this mapping, the mapping between theta ij and psi spin theta ij has a gauge redundancy. So I'll say what that means in a second. It's not a one-to-one mapping. Many values of theta ij correspond to the same physical state. Unlike twisting some spin field where every angle that you twist by gives you a different state. Okay, so what is the precise claim about this gauge redundancy? So the precise claim is that if you look at psi spin and you change theta ij by what we might call a gauge transformation. So we add to it, say chi I. So this would be a typical, so let me just write it down and then I'll see what it means. So the claim is that if I modify theta ij in this way, I get the same state back again up to a phase. I mean, the phase is of course always a matter of choice. So it's sort of, I'm just emphasizing it doesn't, yeah, the phase isn't even, is always ambiguous, right? So that phase, you shouldn't pay too much attention to that phase there. So what this looks like is like a gauge transformation, right? If you think of theta ij as like a vector potential, then this is like a typical gauge transformation that I'm doing here. Whoops, no, a little lagging here. It's like a gauge transformation and it's giving us the same state back again. Okay, so let's see why this is true. So it's just, we can check it pretty straightforwardly. It's just it has to do with the fact that we have a projection going on. And because of this projection, some changes to our mean field ansatz actually don't do anything to the physical states. That's really where it comes from. So anyway, so projection naturally gives you kind of gauge redundancy. That's the moral of the story. But anyway, to see how it works, to see this, basically let's notice that this changing theta ij in this way, if we look at our mean field Hamilton, our mean field ansatz, if we change theta ij in this way, what it does is it's just a unitary, it can be, changing theta ij in this way can be obtained by just doing a unitary transformation. So I'll write it like this. There exists some V chi, I'll define in a second, such that when you conjugate H naught by V chi, it gives you exactly this H naught, this modified H naught. And what is V chi? V chi is e to the I sum of chi I Fi alpha dagger. So this is easy to see. If you conjugate your H naught by this unitary, it will induce exactly these phases, basically because this operator changes the phase of f by e to the I chi. And so it changes f dagger f by e to the I chi, it changes our hopping term by e to the I chi I minus chi j. So that's why this is true. So this change of ansatz is really doing this unitary transformation. So then that means that if we look at the ground state, the ground states are all related by this unitary transformation. The ground state, fermion Hamiltonian. So now we're almost done because we know how the ground state changes. Now let's ask how the projection of the ground state changes. So if we just apply P to both sides of this equation, we get P of psi naught theta ij plus chi I minus chi j is equal to P times V chi. And now let's think about what P times V chi is. So if you look at, if you look over here, you can see that if you apply P to this operator, you're projecting to the states with single fermion occupancy. And so that's gonna just, V chi will just become a phase factor. So this whole V chi, we can pull it out. Whoops. And it just becomes a phase factor, E to the I sum of chi. Right, because you can just see that by the definition of the projection operator, within that projected subspace, V chi is just a phase. And so now we're done, because on the left-hand side of this equation, we have the spin state with this thing up here, this spin state with the modified ansatz, and on the right side, we have it with the original ansatz, and they differ by a phase. Each this prefactor here is a phase. So, So that proves the claim. And so, okay, so what do we learn from this? As I said, we learn there's this gauge redundancy in these fluctuations. And so we can actually think of this as a kind of gauge fluctuation. I'm not gonna say in detail what it means in the effective theory, because I don't think we have time, but if people are interested, I could talk about it maybe later, but we can, we can see a hint of a gauge structure, and we can think of this as something like a gauge fluctuation, a fluctuation of that gauge field. And we can see that the gauge fluctuation has a physical wave function in terms of spins. So that's kind of reassuring that this gauge structure isn't totally, we can see what it means sort of microscopically. Okay, so that's the first thing I wanted to talk about. That's sort of all I wanted to say about the physical picture for gauge fluctuations. What I want to do next is just do one more example. So I'm changing gears a little bit. I want to just do one more example of a spin liquid. I think it's useful to do one more example. And in particular, I'm going to do an example of a gap spin liquid. Because gap spin liquids are a little bit easier. They're a little bit more well-controlled. They're properties, and so it's nice to have at least one example like that. So I'm going to talk about a Z2 spin liquid. So I needed just to describe the spin liquid, I have to tell you what the ansatz is, and then we can work out what the wave function and what the low energy theory is. So the ansatz is going to be look like the following. It's a little bit more complicated than our previous ansatz. It has both hopping and pairing terms. It's a little more complicated than the pi flux state. So it has a hopping term and it has a pairing term. That's important to make the symmetry Z2 rather than U1, to make the gauge theory Z2 rather than U1. So it has both hopping and pairing, and actually it also has some on-site, I think, if I understand this state correctly, it also has an on-site pairing term, which I'm going to write like this. So delta 3, I'm sorry for the notation, it's just some other pairing, some other complex number that describes pairing on a single site. Okay, and now I need to tell you what the whether these hopping and pairing parameters, not so much that because the details matter, but just to be concrete. So basically it turns out that, maybe I should draw a picture. For this particular spin liquid, it's on a square lattice, we have our spins here. The hopping is actually, let me draw all the, the hopping is just sort of nearest neighbor hopping. So it's like horizontal or vertical hopping. So I'll write it like this. So T, there's only hopping to nearest neighbors. And it's just some parameter we'll call T. And the same parameter in the X and Y direction. But the pairing actually occurs across the diagonals. So there's actually pairing. I'm going to draw these bonds because there's some interactions that occur. You could call them second nearest neighbor pairing. So the pairing is delta I plus x hat plus y hat. And the pairing across these two bonds differs by complex conjugation. So just write it. Okay, the details don't matter that much. I just want to write it down. So this is so there's some complex pairing amplitude, delta one plus I delta two. And the pairing across these two diagonal bonds those two amplitudes are complex conjugates of each other. And these parameters, they're actually, I guess, four parameters, T, delta one, delta two, and then this parameter delta three that's is up here. So those parameters pretty much can take any value, but they need to be non-zero. Okay, so that's the ansatz. And this ansatz has some nice properties. So let me just work out what the, let's work out the low energy theory, and then I'll just tell you about some of the, a few other properties. So first let's find the low energy theory. So to find the low energy theory, we need to find the symmetry transformations. We first have to find the gauge group, right? So we have to find the symmetry transformations that preserve that preserve both our ansatz H naught and also all our physical operators SI. You remember that SI are written as a fermion bilinear, and so if we want to do that. It's easy to see that because we have this pairing term, we no longer have those phase transformations, the U1 symmetry transformations. We actually, the only ones we get are Z2 in this, for this ansatz. This is really not transformation. But this one you can see, it does indeed preserve our Hamiltonian, of course, because it's fermion parity conserving. And it obviously, it also preserves our spin operator because they're fermion bilinears. And that's it. It's this and the identity transformation. So that the group in this case is just Z2. So now that we have the group, we then follow the same recipe as before. So we need to introduce now, we need to couple our low energy, our mean field Hamiltonian to a Z2 gauge field. So we're going to introduce Z2 gauge fields on the links of our lattice. So let me draw a picture. So in this case, because we have, there are different ways of doing it, but because we have pairing across the diagonals, I'm gonna actually introduce Z2 gauge fields on all the links of this, not sure what you call this lattice that I'm drawing here. So every link on this lattice, whether it's horizontal, vertical, or diagonal, I'm going to introduce the Z2 gauge field. And so just to give them a name, if I call this site I and this site J, I'm going to introduce the gauge field. There's going to be a gauge field that lives on that link. And I'll call it ZIJ. This is just the usual notation for a Z2 gauge field. It can take two values, plus or minus one. Those are the two elements of Z2. So we're going to introduce those Z2 gauge fields, sigma ZIJ on the links. So it's like a spin 1/2 degree of freedom on every link. And then we can write down our low energy theory according to the slave fermion construction. So the low energy theory then is, the first part of it is of course just taking our original mean field Hamiltonian and coupling it to these Z2 gauge fields. So we take the term and then we add in sigma ZIJ. Because when it fermions hop across a link, of course they're charged under this Z2. You can see that over here. And so they when they hop across a link, they should see this gauge field, the sigma Z gauge field. And then similarly, the pairing term also, you want to put in that, under the minimal coupling prescription, you should put in that gauge field. Okay, so that's, oh, and then there's the, of course, there's the on-site term, but the on-site term, there's no gauge field, right? Because they're not hopping across any links. So it just, it's left basically the same. Okay, so that's the first part of our gauge theory. But then of course, the second part is that the term is just the gauge field itself. And then these terms, the usual terms you write down, the most basic terms for Z2 gauge field, there's two of them. One is, I'll just write them down. It's what you might call the electric field term, creates fluctuations in the flux. And then there's sort of the magnetic term. And this one, now here, the minimal plaquette you can write down is a triangle. So I'm gonna write down flux through, it's gonna sum over all the triangles, basically. And through each triangle, we have this term. And so the second term here makes you wanna have, makes the product of sigma z's wanna be one, which is like saying you have zero flux through those triangles. And the first term here, the sigma x term, is making the flux fluctuate. And then as always, we wanna be in this weakly fluctuating regimes, or you could call it the deconfined regime in this case. So we want H to be small. This, we want the, this electric field term to be small. So we want H to be much smaller. In particular, we'll make it much smaller than both T and delta, which will make smaller than K. Okay, so that's the low energy theory. Then the last thing I have to tell you is what's the gauge invariance constraint. And I won't go through, I'll just tell you the answer, but you can follow the same prescription that we discussed yesterday. And what you find for the gauge invariance constraint is something that looks like, again, it looks kind of like a traditional Gauss's law for Z2 gauge field. So product of sigma x, in this case, you wanna take the product of sigma x over all the links. In this case, there are, what are there, 8 links that, that are around this site I. So that's what I mean by this picture down here. When I down here, it's all 8 links coming out from site I, and you want that product of sigma x. Usually you would set that equal to the -1 to the number of fermions, but actually, just like in the pi flux case, it's not quite that. It's -1 to the number of fermions, -1. There's this offset, which is very important. This is like a, again, it's like there's a background, sort of you can interpret it as a background Z2 gauge charge at each site, this -1 here. Anyway, this is what just comes out of the, if you just follow the prescription for finding the gauge invariance constraint. So that's it. That's our low energy theory. Z2 gauge theory coupled to fermions with a particular gauge invariance constraint that sort of says there's a background charge on every site. Okay, so next thing I wanna talk about is the properties of this low energy theory. And this, unlike the pi flux case, it's like this one we can really understand rather, I think it's very well controlled in this limit. We know exactly what the behavior is, at least for the low energy theory. It's so that's nice. So so let's talk about some of the properties. So so first property is actually just about the wave function itself. So this spin wave function it's invariant under all the spin rotation and lattice symmetries. And that's, you have to check that. Like, so that's why, you know, certain pairing terms or complex conjugates of other pairing terms, they were set up in a particular way to ensure that under all the symmetries, rotation and translation and all crystal symmetries, it's actually invariant under that. So you can check that. So it's actually a spin liquid state, which is nice. And then that's the property of the wave function. As far as the low energy theory is concerned, well, we can see from above, the low energy theory consists of spin 1/2 fermions coupled to a Z2 gauge field, right? So low energy theory consists of, oh, and the key point, I should say this. If you work out this, the energy spectrum of H naught, original ansatz, it's gapped. it's a completely gapped. So these are gapped spin one half fermions. Unlike the pi flux case when they were gapless, this is gapped spin one half fermions, which we can call spinons, coupled to a Z2 gauge field. So the theory is completely gapped. The gauge flux is gapped, the gauge fluctuations are gapped, and the spins are also gapped. Everything's gapped. It's a fully gapped theory, and this is what you would call, and it carries it's as you probably already know, it carries a topological order. It has anion-like excitations, and these anion excitations are exactly like that in the Tor code. So sometimes we say it has Z2 topological order. But unlike the Tor code, their symmetry numbers, quantum numbers are different. Like we have these spin one half spinons and so on, which you don't have in the Tor code. So the anions are the same, but some of the symmetry quantum numbers are different. And that's kind of what makes this state interesting. You know, what you might say, why do we need this construction when we have the Tor code? Well, one reason is that it allows you to construct different types of, like spin liquids, for example, where you don't break any symmetry and where you have spin one half spinons. That's, we don't really know how to do that with exactly solvable models, at least as far as I know. Okay, so, all right, so that's my second example of a spin liquid. What I wanna do, and we'll come back to this example at the end, because as I said, it's kind of a well-controlled example. So it's a nice example to think about the Parton construction or the slave fermion construction and think about like precise questions about whether it's the construction actually is correct or not. So we'll come back to it. What I wanna do now is actually move on to the second application of the Parton construction and tell you just a little bit about how you can use the Parton construction for quantum Hall states. And then after that, I hope I'll have a little time at the end to come back to these, probably a big question that's on lots of your minds, which is, you know, why should we believe this construction? Is it correct? That kind of thing. So let me now just tell you a little bit about quantum Hall, the application of quantum Hall. Before I do that, I just have to briefly review, just make sure we're on the same page, just briefly review what setting. So brief review of quantum Hall states, and then we can talk about how we use the Parton construction. So this is just gonna be very quick, but so just to remind you, the setting for the quantum Hall effect and for thinking about quantum Hall states is we're thinking about in this N, let's say electrons, and actually we're gonna ignore the spin of the electrons. So we can think of them as spinless electrons, N spinless electrons, in 2D in a perpendicular magnetic field. Okay, so that's the setting. So we have some 2D, they're confined in two dimensions with some semiconductor heterostructure. And we have our electrons moving in here, and then we have a perpendicular magnetic field B. And so then the Hamiltonian, the kind of Hamiltonian that we're interested in is something that I'm gonna write in second quantized notation, which is because that's gonna be useful when we go to the Parton description. So in second quantized notation, the usual kinetic energy term, P squared over 2M, or P minus A squared over 2M, looks like something like this. So I'm gonna call the electron creation operator C dagger. So C dagger R I grad plus A of R. A is the vector potential. Background vector potential. Okay, so that's just the kinetic term, right? P squared or P minus A squared over 2M, just written in second quantized notation. And then, in a continuum. But of course, in addition to the kinetic term, there's very important interactions. Coulomb interactions, for example, or maybe short range interactions, depending on the system you're thinking. And then this vector potential, of course, is chosen so that its curl is B. It's a uniform in space and points in the Z direction. Okay, so that's the system we're interested in, and the Hamiltonian describes it. And then just one more piece of notation to just remind you is that the notion of filling fraction. So it's very useful to define the quantity nu, which is just the number of electrons divided by the number of flux quanta in your system. Flux quanta, basically the amount of 2 pi, it's the number of 2 pi fluxes that puncture your system. That's a ratio that we would usually be holding fixed while we take a thermodynamic limit. And that ratio is, in this notation, well, the number of electrons is N, and the number of flux quanta is magnetic field times, well, if I think of this as some finite system of size Lx and Ly, then it's B times Lx, Ly. And then I guess to normalize it, you should divide by 2 pi. It's the amount of 2 pi fluxes that puncture your system. That's the number of flux quanta. Okay, so that so then, as you probably know, the filling fraction, or equivalently by varying, say, the magnetic field, it's certain special values of filling fraction, you get gap states. And you also can get interesting gapless states, but I'm mostly going to focus on gap states here. So you can get gap states, they occur at special rational values of the filling fraction. Okay, so that's the lightning review of quantum Hall. Now what I wanna do is talk about how to construct some of these interesting gap states using the Parton construction. So Parton construction, quantum Hall states. So I'm gonna actually just do like the absolute simplest example, which is you're gonna see. Well, I don't want to break the surprise, but it's the simplest example. So I'm going to consider a quantum Hall system with n electrons and 3n flux quanta. Which means we're at filling fraction 1/3. Okay, and we want to try to construct a candidate state at this filling fraction. So what we're going to do is we're going to play a similar game to the Slave-Fermion approach. We're kind of going to work with a larger Hilbert space and actually construct a state within the larger Hilbert space and then project it down to the space of interest. So to construct a candidate state, let's consider a larger Hilbert space. And then this larger Hilbert space is going to be basically, it's going to consist of three species of fermions, not just one. So it's consisting of three species of fermions, which we'll call partons. For reasons that will become clear, they're kind of parts of the electron, partons. And those partons we'll call I'll call them F1, F2, F3. Those will be their annihilation operators. Okay? And so we have these three species of fermions, and I'm going to assume that we have n particles from each species. So I'll together three n partons. Okay, so if I just draw the picture, now instead of dealing with black dots, which are our electrons, now what we have is something totally different. We have, I'm gonna draw them in different colors. We have like some red fermions, red partons, and some blue ones. And then we also have some green ones, and n of each species. Okay, so that's it's a much bigger Hilbert space. We have many more states because we have all these, we have more particles and they come in different types. But the basic idea is similar to before. Although it's a much bigger Hilbert space, we can think of the electron Hilbert space as sitting inside of it. So we can embed the electron Hilbert space, H electron, inside of this H parton. And the way we can do that is basically we can think of an electron as like case where the three partons are all on, we say that there's an electron on a given site if all three partons sit on that site. In other words, or not, sit in that point in space. In other words, we think of the electron as a composite of three partons. Okay, so I'll just draw that schematically, what that means. Basically, every electron state has a corresponding parton state. So these electrons are black dots. So this is some electron state. And then the corresponding parton state would be one where I just the partons sit exactly where the electrons are, and they all are. There's a red one, a green one, and a blue one, all sitting where that electron was sitting. Whoops. Blue. Okay, so it's a very special set of states, but these states, these particular parton states, we'll identify with the electron states. And so in that way, we can think of the electron Hilbert space as sitting inside the parton Hilbert space. So in terms of operators, maybe that's an easier way to say it. In terms of operators, what this means is we can identify the electron operator as just the product of the electron destruction operator. Whoops, F1, F2, F3 is what I meant to write. As a product of three parton operators. Okay, so that's another way of saying electron is a composite of three partons. And that's really where this language parton comes from, because we're breaking the electron into kind of parts, sort of similar to the Schwinger, to the slave fermions, where we broke a spin into parts. Okay, so we've embedded the electron Hilbert space inside of the parton Hilbert space, and we've identified the electron operator as a product of three parton operators. So the next step is we need to choose a kind of parton Hamiltonian. So this is just like in the slave fermion approach, the input into the parton construction is a parton Hamiltonian. So we need to choose a parton Hamiltonian. H-naught, and this choice, we're gonna need two properties. We can't just choose it arbitrarily. So one property, this one maybe isn't totally essential, but at least for our purposes, we're gonna want H naught to be gapped. So it's gonna be a gapped parton Hamiltonian. And that's just because this is assuming we wanna construct a gap state. Which is what I'm gonna focus on here. So we're going to want H naught to be gapped. The other thing that we're going to want, and this is kind of analogous to this slave fermion construction, is in general, if we call the ground state, think about the ground state of this H naught, which we can call psi naught. In general, that ground state, of course, does not live in the electron Hilbert space. But we want it to kind of live on there on average. So what does that mean to live on average? Well, it should mean that the average density of the three species of partons should all be equal. So the ground state psi naught should satisfy this condition. So the density, it can be written as the expectation value of F1 dagger F1. We want this to hold. So if I took away the expectation values, this would be the constraint to live in the electron Hilbert space. And so it's the same thing as before. I've taken a constraint and I've weakened it to just say I should hold on average. The average density should be equal, not the exact density. It shouldn't be equal at the operator level, just the expectation value should be equal. And of course, I also want this to be equal to I'll just say that. I also want this to be, Well, I guess I already said the number of these fermions, so maybe that's fine. So this is the second constraint. And so we need to find, and once we have an H naught that obeys these two conditions, then we can construct basically the same thing we did in the slave fermion construction. So we can construct an electron state, a state that lives in the honest to goodness electron Hilbert space, and we can also construct energy theory. So it will take this H naught as input and then construct these two things. So let me just tell you how that works. So first I can tell you how, it's very similar to the slave fermion construction, almost the same idea, almost identical. So to construct the electron state from this data, basically you take that state psi naught, which is sort of in the electron Hilbert space on average, and you force it to live in the electron Hilbert space. You project it into it. So you can construct an electron state, which I'll call psi e, by just projecting psi naught. So this is the projection into H electron. And if you want to write this in terms of wave functions, you can. So in terms of wave functions, this projection, it basically forces all the partons to live at the same point in space. So if you write it in terms of wave functions, what it does is you want to write an electron wave function on some coordinates, let's call them, I'm going to call them zi. The electron wave function is obtained by taking the parton wave function, which would be a function of the coordinates, I'll call them zi1, zi2, zi3. These are the coordinates of the three species of partons. So you would take it would be equal to that, but then what does this projection do? What this projection does is it basically throws out all the states except for those where the z's are equal. So you want to take this and basically set, well, I'm running out of space here, you want to set z1i equal to z2i equal to z3i equal to zi. Okay, so that's, you set all three z's equal and equal to some coordinate, which you call now zi, and then that gives you a wave function on electrons. So that's what this projection amounts to if you write in terms of wave functions. And just to remind you here, the z's that we're thinking about are complex coordinates, x plus i, y. That's the most convenient way to describe quantum Hall wave functions. So it's just forcing those parton coordinates to all be locked together. That's what all we do. And that gives us some state. So that's the construction of the electron state. And then the construction of low energy theory, I'm not gonna repeat it because we'll see it in an example if we have time, but it's basically exactly the same as before. So it's similar to before. You look for the symmetries of your ansatz, and that determines some gauge group. And then you couple your parton Hamiltonian to that gauge theory, and that gives you the low energy theory. Okay, so what I want to do is just do an example where we can see this in practice. So let's do an example. So basically I have to give you an ansatz and then I'm going to construct a wave function and a low energy theory. So the ansatz I'm going to choose is maybe the simplest ansatz that has the properties you want. It's going to be non-interacting and it's going to be, it's just going to be, basically the partons are going to be moving in some magnetic field, but not quite the same magnetic field that the original electrons are moving in. So if I write it out in second quantized notation, I'm gonna write it like this, Fp dagger r of I grad, and they see some vector potential, but their vector potential that they see is divided by 3. So they're seeing, like what this means is they see 1/3 the magnetic field that the electrons see. Okay, so this is a perfectly fine a perfectly fine Hamiltonian, and it's well, we'll see in a second, but it has all the properties we want. It's a gapped. We'll see it's a gapped Hamiltonian, and it has the I'm summing over p's here. So each of the three partons are experiencing the same magnetic field, and so they're going to end up having the same density. So it'll have all the properties we want. So okay, so what does this mean physically? So this Hamiltonian means, as I said, the partons are moving in a an effective magnetic field, which is one third the physical magnetic field. So the magnetic field is like B over 3. So you may remember that the electrons were at one third filling. So that means that the partons are actually going to be at filling 1, because the magnetic field, they're n partons, but now the number of flux quanta is, instead of 3n, it's n, right? So they're n partons in n flux quanta, at least as far as they're concerned. And so each parton is actually at filling 1, and so that's why this is gapped. This is actually, the ground state of H0 is just a single filled Landau level. So each parton species is in a nu equals 1 integer quantum state. In other words, one filled Landau level. So so it's gapped. It's just, we don't need any interactions to create a gap. It's gapped even before we add interactions. It's just a single filled Landau level. And they're all at the same density, so they obey that second property we wanted. Okay, so now that's the H naught. Now we can find the ground state. So the ground state, psi naught, it's a function of these parameters, or these coordinates, Zi1, Zi2, Zi3. And since each of the partons is just in a nu equals 1 state, the wave function is just a product of three nu equals 1 wave functions. So I'll just write that out. Whoops, I have too many parentheses there. So, Ci2, I ran out of space. Ci3. So it's just a product of three. It's a product of three integer quantum Hall wave functions. And then let's write it out more explicitly. So what do these integer quantum Hall wave functions look like? Well, so let me just write it in terms of coordinates z1 through zn. But these z's should be Zi1 or Zi2, Zi3. I'm just not writing the superscript here. So what does this wave function look like? Well, you may know that the integer quantum Hall wave function, if you work in the circular gauge, it has this really nice structure. It just looks like product of Zi minus Zj. And then there's the Gaussian factor, Zi squared. And it should be divided by 4 times the magnetic length squared. But the magnetic length here is actually going to be 3 times, there's an extra factor 3, because the magnetic field is one third the usual factor. So it's going to be 3 times L squared, where L is 1 over root B. And the reason for that factor 3 is because the partons are seeing one third the magnetic field. So that's the wave function of each parton species, and then the full wave function is just a product of those three of them. Okay, so now we can write down the electron wave function. Probably already guessed what we're going to get, so let's just do it though. So the electron wave function So that's obtained by just If we go back here to this this wave function here, just set the three coordinates equal to each other and set them all equal to zi. So it's just going to give us the cube of the it's the integer quantum Hall wave function cubed. Okay, and then, okay, if I just write that out explicitly, I get product I less than j, I get zi minus cj cubed. And then the Gaussian factor, that factor three gets canceled off, and I end up with zi squared over four L squared. And that is exactly the wave function for the Laughlin state. So that's the wave function for the Laughlin state. Okay, so so our ansatz wave function we get out is in this case is definitely physical. It's in fact exactly the Laughlin state, and it may look like some trickery that we like reverse engineered it, but it kind of pops out if you just put in those requirements on H naught and you try to look for a gap state for your partons. You're forced, at least the simplest case, is to just put them in integer quantum Hall states, and then this is what you get. Okay. So that's the wave function. The next thing I want to do is just quickly write down calculate the low energy theory. And that we'll see that the low energy theory that we get is also kind of the expected low energy theory for the Laughlin state. Okay, so to get the low energy theory, what we need to do is find the symmetry transformations that preserve H naught and all our physical operators, which in this case is basically the things built out of the electron operator. So we want to find all the symmetry transformations that preserve H naught and then this C, this fermion annihilation operator. And so, okay, so let me write them down. So one thing you can do is you can multiply F1 by a phase and multiply F2 by the opposite phase. And that's perfectly okay because, certainly our parton Hamiltonian is invariant under that because it's number conserving. But also our electron operator is invariant under that since the electron operator is a product of the three Fs. So that's one transformation that preserves it. Another transformation that would preserve H naught and C is you could do the phases a little differently. Like you could multiply F1 times, let's say, by lambda F1, and you could leave F2 alone, and then you could multiply F3 by e to the minus I lambda F3. Okay, again, for the same reasons before, that will preserve both the electron operator and the Hamiltonian H naught. So, okay, so you may say, okay, these are our two transformations. They're each parameterized by U1. Of course, you can take products of them, but that doesn't, so altogether you get U1 cross U1. That's, okay, so that is basically sort of right and sort of not right. So, so strictly speaking, I'm kind of cheating here. There's actually more symmetry transformations than these two, because you can do SU3 symmetry transformations where you mix together the three fermions. So you can multiply F1, F2, F3 by some SU3 matrix. That's kind of a generalization of these two transformations I've written down. And that also preserves, because my H naught, the way I wrote H naught, it was actually SU3 symmetric in this P index. P runs from 1 to 3. So strictly speaking, there's actually SU3 symmetry, and you can analyze it if you do it that way, and it gives you but it's more complicated because you have an SU3 gauge theory, and in the end, you end up getting the same answer. So what I want to do here is, strictly speaking, what I've written is only correct if we somehow break the symmetry between these three fermions. if we break the symmetry, like maybe we give them different masses or something, or put it on a lattice and somehow break the symmetry between F1, F2, and F3 in H0. If we don't break the symmetry, then if I didn't break the symmetry, G would be SU3, which you can analyze and actually end up getting the same answer. Whether you break the symmetry or don't, you get the same, at least the same topological field theory in the end, the equivalent topological field theories. But it's a bit, it's more complicated to think about the SU3 case. So here, if you like, I'm going to imagine that we somehow modify H0, maybe by putting on a lattice, maybe by changing the masses of the three fermions, so that the symmetry group is actually U1 cross U1. Okay, so that's what we're going to do. So then the group really is U1 cross U1, and these are the only two transformations. Those SU3 transformations are not allowed because we've broken the symmetry between the three fermions. Okay, so now that's the case, then we're going to have two gauge fields corresponding to these U1s, and I'm going to denote them by A1 and A2. And A1 will be the one on the left. So F1 is charged under A1, and F1 carries unit charge under A1, F2 carries -1 charge under A1, and similarly for A2, the charges can be read off by looking on the right. So now let's just write down our effective theory. So our effective theory is obtained. The first term, of course, is by doing this minimal coupling prescription. So we take our original parton Hamiltonian, and then we couple to these gauge fields, and I use this something, a certain matrix, I'll define it in a second, QPQ, which tells you the charges under the different gauge fields. So I'll tell you what QPQ is in a second. So that first term is going to be basically the minimal coupling. We've added in this gauge field, this extra gauge field in this, the two extra U1 gauge fields that are now coupled to our partons. And then, of course, we have to add in the energetic terms, the gauge field terms. And so there's sum over two gauge fields. And there's just the usual terms for U1 gauge theory. So each gauge field is going to have an electric field energy term. And we'll have a flux or magnetic energy term. Okay, so that's just the usual Maxwell electrodynamics Hamiltonian for our two gauge fields. And then this QPQ, I'll just write it down. It just tells you the charges under our gauge fields. It's the matrix that corresponds to up here, there's a 1 and a -1 and a 0 in this column, and then a 1, 0, -1 on the right. And that's this thing. So that's just telling the charges that the different fermions are carrying. And then finally, I should write down the gauge invariance constraint. And again, you can follow basically the same prescription as in the Slade fermion approach. And the gauge invariance constraint that you get is, it actually doesn't have any background charge at all. So it just looks like kind of a traditional gauge, traditional Gauss's law without any -1s. The reason there are no -1s is essentially because these transformations we've written here, they kind of act trivially in the physical Hilbert space. There's no e to the I chi offset. So that's it. So that's our low energy theory. So if we just take stock at it, we have three species of fermions, each filling nu equals one, and they're coupled to these two U1 gauge fields. And now if I had time, what I would do is you can analyze this theory because you can go further with this. You can replace your new equals one states with Chern-Simons fields. There's a Chern-Simons description. And then each parton gives you a Chern-Simons field. So you'd end up with five gauge fields, three corresponding to our partons and two corresponding to our A1 and A2 that we have here. So you'd have a Chern-Simons theory with five fields. But then you can integrate out the two, you can integrate out the two A1 and A2. And if you do that, it turns out that you go from a theory with five gauge fields to one with just a single gauge field. And in fact, it gives you exactly the Chern-Simons. Because when you integrate those out, it basically gives you two constraints on our remaining three gauge fields, the ones that come from the partons. And so those two constraints reduce the three remaining gauge fields now down to one. So you end up with a single Chern-Simons field, and it's exactly the usual Chern-Simons theory. So I'll just say dot, 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 and then with a little bit of work, you can reduce this to, and you end up with a factor of three coming from the fact that there are three parton species. You end up with 3/4 pi, I'll write it as BdB, where this means, maybe I should write out explicitly, epsilon mu nu. Okay, you get the usual Chern-Simons theory. And this is exactly the known effective theory for the Laughlin state. At least it describes the topological properties correctly. So you can get all the statistics of all the particles and everything from this. So anyway, the punchline is the effective theory is correct. It gives you the right, at least in terms of topological properties, everything matches the known properties of the Laughlin state. So that's a nice check on this construction. What I want to do in the remaining time, sorry to go kind of fast, but I just want to, so that's kind of all I was going to say about quantum Hall. I should just advertise, you know, with this construction, you can obviously do a lot more than the Laughlin state. You can do all the Jain states, many abelian states and non-abelian states happen very naturally, basically because you can get, as I sort of intimated over here, very naturally you can get gauge fields, which are things like SU3. And in general, that gives you a non-abelian Chern-Simons theory. In this particular case, the SU3, it turns out to be SU3 level one, which is by level rank duality is equivalent to this theory I've written here. But in general, it gives you something non-abelian. So you can get very interesting states from this construction in addition to the well-known states. Okay, so that's just an advertisement. If you want to know more about that, you can look at the references I suggested. So what I want to talk about in the remaining time is just a little bit about, is this parton construction correct? Of course, the answer is, at least to some extent, I think the answer is it is, otherwise I wouldn't talk about it. But in what sense is it correct? And I just want to tell you a little bit about some, trying to make precise in what sense it's correct and maybe why we should believe it's correct. So I'm going to focus on the slave fermion case, just for concreteness. So the slave fermion construction. So they're basically, as I mentioned, they're kind of two main claims. There's two issues we would want to ask about the slave fermion construction. One is the wave function. Is the wave function correct? In what sense is it correct or physical? And the second question is the low energy theory. Now, I won't say much about this, but this is also mentioned in some, I think in the Balance and Savory article, but the wave functions are probably not strictly correct in the sense that there exist counterexamples.
Hi, Michael, just want to let you know you have 10 minutes left.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I'll try to wrap up. Okay, so there exist counterexamples where Psi spin, the spin wave function, is unphysical. So it doesn't look like the physical ground state. Well, I don't know if we can prove it, but it seems unlikely that it's the ground state of a physical spin Hamiltonian. And there are also examples where maybe it's physical, but it's not in the right phase. So in other words, it doesn't agree with the effective theory. Okay, so for that reason, I'm going to focus on the low energy theory. I'm not going to try to make any precise statements or conjectures about the wave function because I'm not sure if there are any precise statements you can make. I should say, by the way, it does work in many cases, though. The wave function isn't totally, it's not clear. It always works. It's hard to make precise statements about it. So let's focus on the low energy theory. So let me just state like two conjectures that I think are reasonable about low energy theory and then maybe why I think they're reasonable. So conjecture one, basically I want to make the weakest possible conjecture you can make about the low energy theory, which is that the low energy theories you get from this construction are all physical, meaning they correctly describe the low energy excitations of some spin Hamiltonian. So every low energy theory obtained from the slave fermion construction is physical, i.e., it correctly describes the low energy excitations of some spin Hamiltonian. Okay, in some sense, this doesn't seem like that strong a statement. It's just saying there exists some spin Hamiltonian whose low energy excitations match the low energy excitations of your effective theory. But there is some content to it. It's not like, it's not obvious, but that's the statement. Now to make it more precise, it's good to focus on an example. So to make this more precise, let's focus on an example. So we could focus on let's think about the Z2 spin liquid example in particular. So let H effective be the Hamiltonian defined in the Z2 spin liquid example. Okay, so we wrote it down earlier today. I want to make a conjecture that says that particular Hamiltonian is physical. And in what sense does it mean it's physical? It means, I think the way you would say it is the following. There exists an interpolation. You can continuously interpolate between that Hamiltonian, which lives in this, which has this big Hilbert space. It seems totally unphysical, but the claim is there's some interpolation between that Hamiltonian and essentially a spin Hamiltonian. So more precisely, I want to say there exists a symmetry preserving gapped interpolation between H effective and a Hamiltonian of the following form. So this Hamiltonian that I'm claiming we can interpolate to would look like some spin Hamiltonian. And then it has its gauge field dynamics are totally trivial. It's just totally confined, like this. So this is where H spin is a gapped spin Hamiltonian. So I think conjecture two is saying we can interpolate to something that's like a spin Hamiltonian, and then all the gauge fields are just in this trivial product state, at least in the ground state. They're all in the sigma x equals one state. And so if such an interpolation exists, I think most people would agree that means that the H spin then is our spin Hamiltonian, whose who realizes the same physics as H effective. So this is the kind of thing one would want to prove, is that that although we're working in this weird big Hilbert space that seems unphysical, we can interpolate continuously to a Hamiltonian H spin, which lives in our spin Hilbert space, plus some, if you like, ancillas, these gauge fields, which are all in a product state. If that's the kind of thing you want to show. Now, I'm pretty much out of time. So I'll just say it in words instead of writing it. Why should we believe conjecture two, for example? Conjecture two, I think, is pretty precise. And so we can ask why we should believe it, that such interpolation exists. And maybe one argument for it is that such interpolation almost certainly does exist if we look in the limit where H is very large, right? We can consider this limit, which is usually not the limit we're interested in. If so, go back to our original Z2 spin liquid Hamiltonian. If you take the limit where H is very large, if you take the limit where H is very large, that's then the, you can kind of neglect these other terms, this K term. And then the you can work in kind of perturbation theory. So like if you take the limit where H is basically infinite, you know sigma X's are all zero. So you can work in perturbation theory when H, do perturbation theory in Tij and maybe just set K to be zero. And then what you get is exactly some spin Hamiltonian. I think it's actually the Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet. Plus this sigma X term. So in the limit where H is very large, it's already, H effective already looks kind of like a spin Hamiltonian plus a sigma X term, at least in perturbation theory. So it's almost certainly true that such an interpolation exists in the limit where H is very large. And then you would say, well, why do we expect such interpolation to exist when H is small? And there, the kind of hand-waving argument is that the existence or non-existence of this kind of interpolation is really a question about, it's sort of a question about anomalies. It's about whether you capture the right structure of the Hilbert space, like the fact that you have a spin 1/2 on every site. And that kind of information is, generally, we don't think that kind of information about anomalies can change under continuous variation of parameters. So you would somehow, it's a hand-waving argument, but you would expect that if you have the correct structure in one limit of parameters, the same structure must be correct for all parameters. So that's kind of the hand-waving argument for why, even in the deconfined phase where it doesn't, there's such interpolation seems highly non-trivial, why we might expect it to exist, and so why this conjecture is reasonable. So I'm going to stop there because I'm out of time, but that's just some thoughts about trying to make precise what why we should believe the slave fermion construction or what the slave fermion construction is really claiming. So I'll stop there. Thanks.
Yeah, let's thank Michael for the nice lecture. So maybe we will have a bit time for one quick question. So let me just, there is a one question from John McGreevy in the Q&A. So what he asks is, what do we get if we project a state with a wrong average filling? So maybe it is not a ground state of local Hamiltonian, since it comes from the tails of the wave function.
I think maybe what he means is if the average, I don't know if he's talking about the quantum Hall case, but if he's talking, if we were to project something that didn't obey this constraint, where is it? Yeah, this constraint here, where all the densities of all the three fermions are the same. Yeah, that's my feeling, is that you're kind of projecting from the tail of a wave function, so it would cause some problem with the wave function. I think I wouldn't trust at all. Now, whether the low energy theory you could trust, I'd have to think about that. I mean, to be clear, you still need the total number of partons to be equal to the number of electrons. Otherwise, this projection won't even make sense, right? So to have those densities not agree, it means it's inhomogeneous, among other things. So it would be like a situation where one set of partons is mostly on one side of the system and one set of partons is mostly on the other side of the system. It's a very strange situation. Because remember, the number of, this is like condition zero that I didn't write here, but the number of partons has to be equal to the number of electrons. Otherwise, you can't even do this projection. You can't even embed the electron Hilbert space inside the parton Hilbert space. So yeah, to violate this condition would actually mean some kind of inhomogeneity, I think, which is would be, yeah, probably give you something strange. I'm not sure.
Okay, thanks. So we will have the Q&A session at the end of this day. So you can ask questions during that session. So let's thank Michael Levin and Xu Yang Song again for this